Good evening, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Valley Writers Read. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, always happy to introduce another fine Valley author, who tonight happens to be Howard Hendricks, a writer we've had on many times. He's a professor out at Fresno State, lives up at Shaver Lake, where he writes mostly great science fiction, similar to the story we're going to hear tonight. He entitles tonight's story, Red Rover, Red Rover. And here he is to read it for us.
Red Rover, Red Rover. I look down at the moons in the quick of my fingernails. I look up through the dome at the fingernail moons in the dead of the Martian night. I remember my dog Cogsey's nails on my arms when he jumped up to greet me, and I think about the quick and the dead. Did I drive my dog mad? Odd question to ask, even now. Lots of people claim their pets drive them crazy, but I've never heard anybody claim the opposite. Cogsey was a good deal more than just an animal companion, though. So perhaps it's not so strange that I remember the exact moment when I first suspected a change in him. Boss, why did you want to move to Mars, if you don't mind my asking? I looked up from the solar array console I was reprogramming. Behind the merciless pink sky reflected in his helmet's gold visor, Cogsey gazed at me quizzically. Calling him a cinnamon-colored ridgeback with soft brown eyes would be too easy. For beneath his environment suit, he was the color of places we had walked together, the color of tree bark in giant sequoia groves, of playas in the Martian highlands. The ridge on Cogsey's back, the pattern of reversed fur with its rounded head and tapering tail, always reminded me of the streak a shooting star makes, slashing deep into atmosphere. Yes, he was speech augmented. That's what the broad media focused on, but that was the least special thing about him. He had vocoder, voproter implants, sure, but by flipping gene switches, we had also developed his bark and howl brain sites into full-blown speech areas. Vastly expanded cognitive capabilities meant that, from puppyhood on, he was always too clever for anyone's good, including his own. His reading ability, too, was famously off the charts. At first, the vid posters and dog bloggers were primed to hate him even more than they hated me. Yet, in interview after interview, he won his audiences over with his unexpected sense of humor. I remember so clearly that day when one of his early inquisitors demanded how it felt to be a Frankendog. Cogsey said he thanked heaven he was bred out of Rhodesian Ridgeback stock and not Wiener Dog, because he would have hated to go through life as a Frankenfurter, no offense to any dachshunds in the audience. Now, after a six-month spaceflight from Earth and another half a year on Mars, the worst epithet he had to endure from distant Earth was Red Rover, and serving for the refrain to a little pop tune, Red Rover, Red Rover, to Mars come on over. No, Cogsey, I don't mind, I said, straightening up beside the solar array. After all these months, I had almost expected his question. I don't exactly know how to answer you. I mean, you know almost as much of the history of Xanadu Base as I do. Cogsey nodded. 20 years of probes for this project. Orbiters, landers, rovers, oh my. I laughed because it was true. That's right. Then more rockets and robots, too. I remember the probes, scouting both from orbit and on the surface for the lava tube caves with their water ice deposits until they found the ice caves at last. By the one-time shores of a bygone northern ocean, those probes had discovered this site, the best of the lot. Here, three of the long lava tubes had joined, but at that very same juncture had partially collapsed, untold millennia ago. That open space with its connecting tunnels was key. Next had come the advanced robots, arriving on the surface to prep the site, using as their building material the debris cleared from the collapse of the ancient tunnel junction. A cohort of builder bots had then covered that cleared space, formerly open to the sky, with a grand greenhouse dome built of Martian-derived glass.
Other bots constructed the solar array and small nuke plant on the surface, not far from the dome and the ice caves. "Why Mars, I asked, snapping the control console back into position and watching it run through its self-checks. "Well, after Karen and Susie died in the plane crash, I was in danger of becoming a very bitter old man. But I refused to let old age be merely the long, unpleasant aftertaste to every mouthful of my life's feast. Your wife and daughter were always very nice to me. They loved you, Cogsey. My son from my first marriage, too. He likes you better than he likes me." That was no exaggeration. Paul and I had never been particularly close, but he was more than happy to serve as trustee and prince regent for all my corporate holdings, as I had in my time also done for my own father. "When I finally die here on Mars, he will come into full control of all I leave to him, of the legacy I, in my turn, once inherited. I hope, Cogadog, that with what I'm passing on to him, he does as well as I did. For now, he works his work, I mine." "Tennyson." "Very good. But why Mars, right?" "I'm getting to that. Just walking the talk of where my mouth put my money, I suppose. That is why, when I was 62 and you were 8, you and I departed Earth forever while still among the living. The first non-fossil, non-microbial Martian residents." "Exactly. This is a planet for old men and old dogs. Old tricks for a newer world, right, boy? No young in one another's arms, no birds in the trees." "Ah," Cogsey said. "No trees either. No giant dying generations at their song. No salmon falls, no mackerel-crowded seas. No fish, flesh, or fowl commending all summer long for whatever is begotten, born, and dies. Not much of a summer either. William Butler Yeats, if I recall correctly." "You do. You are the most well-read dog I have ever met, Cogs." "Thanks, boss. But in all the media releases, I believe the official term of art was canoid. I prefer plus dog myself. By any name, you're quite special, city of great Zimbabwe. Not just to me, but in yourself. That's why in your pedigree I named you for the capital city of an empire unlike any before or since." We turned away from the now fully reprogrammed solar array. The ever-present cosmic radiation danger limited our stays on the surface, even on a Sol like that day, with the sun declining toward the dust storm adrift on the horizon. We were both happy to be headed back toward the sunny dome and the caves of ice. "You're canoid because of your uniqueness, Cogs." "Then why no opposable thumbs, boss?" I laughed. "For the same reason we didn't make you a biped. Even if you were already halfway to upright, being of the old velt-jumping ridgeback breed. The noble ridgeback, brave as a lion, gentle as a lamb, stubborn as a mule. Opposable thumbs would have made you too special, dangerously so." Cogsey gave his grunting bark of a laugh. "A dog or a canoid can still dream," he said, as I opened the airlock into the greenhouse zone. If I had been a dog, my ears would have perked up at that mention of dreaming. My science advisors, knowing I would have plenty of time in need of filling here on Fourth Rock, had tasked me with numerous experiments and explorations. One of the former was an attempt to determine the effect of pineal and PGO, pons geniculate occipital, wave enhancers on dreaming. Cogsey was the test subject. I told him the study was about using enhanced dreaming to enrich our interaction with the environment and optimize nervous system functionality through neuroplasticity effects. That was true enough, and seemed to satisfy any question he had about the supplements I began putting in his food not long after we arrived on Mars. I shed my suit helmet and helped Cogsey out of his, although with the voice-activated fasteners, he could get in and out of his gear well enough when he wanted or needed to. The pressurized air here in the greenhouse smelled of oxygen and life, so different from the dusty iron world outside. Nose up, Cogsey snuffed the air deeply. "What do you dream, Cogs?" I asked as we walked beneath the sunny dome. "Anything special? Anything Martian?" It was a leading question, of course. While human cognition was supposedly unique in its ability to extend beyond situational thinking's here and now perceptions and motivations, all non-human animal cognition, including Coxie's, was thought to be inherently situated, permanently stuck in the immediate concerns of each moment. At a stratum deeper than what I had explained to Coxie, however, the dream experiment was a test of the hypothesis that two legs is to four legs, not only as lucid dreaming is to ordinary dreaming, but also as waking self-consciousness is to situated cognition. From long experience, I already believed that there was no such hard and fast boundary between the way Coxie's mind worked and the way mine worked, and this experiment could prove it. After what has happened, my belief in that similarity makes it all the harder for me to explain why I manipulated him, like any tool or object, just to prove I was right. The most leading and misleading thing about all of it, though, the way I most treated him like even less than a dog, was that I had also been telling him what to dream. "A lot's that's special lately," Coxie said. "Something Martian, too, but only in a roundabout way." "How's that?" I asked, not paying full attention because at seeing the wheels on the core habitat module as we approached it, I had been plunged into memory. I thought again of our coming out of orbit, landing less than a click from the Xanadu site, the ship levering itself over onto its wheels, turning rover to make its way toward the lava tube cave complex. "Lately I've dreamed I was the Nakhla dog." "The what?" I asked, having drifted further into my reminiscences of when the habitat module was still in rover stage. I had steered it through a gap in the tube wall between where the greenhouse now stood and where the glistening underground ice bank filled and blocked that particular cave tunnel, deeper inside on what had once been the seaward edge. Here the mobile habitat had remained parked ever since, unmoving. We could still travel by solar quad cycle if we didn't want to hoof it, at any rate. "The one killed by the Martian meteorites." I stared at Cogs. Meteorites in the Shergatite Nachlite Chassigny SNC category were the first sky stones from Mars to be found on Earth. The Nachlite group was named after the dog-killing meteorite that crashed near Nakhla in Egypt. Another of our scientific tasks, once on Mars, was to explore and see if we couldn't locate meteorites of earthly origin here, as proof the meteorite exchange went both ways, despite Earth's position deeper in the gravity well. I had flashed on Coxie's meteor ridge of fur and, in what I considered a bolt of inspiration at the time, decided to give him voice-activated access to my Mars Web databases. These were periodically updated from Earth, so the information would be current. I encouraged him to fill his mind with the history of the SNC stones, including the story of the dog killed by the meteorite. That was how I told him what to dream. It paid off, too. With a directness that was as uncanny as it was unerring, Coxie found the only strewn field of meteorites here on Mars that, from their chemical composition, have since proven to be of undeniably terrestrial origin. Honoring an old tradition of meteorite toolmaking found among native peoples from Greenland to Tierra del Fuego, I programmed a fabricator robot to place Smith and machine three of the smithereens into a single fine knife blade. The Nakhla dog was a more obscure part of meteor history than this long toolmaking tradition, but I knew that more obscure part quite well, too. At 9 in the morning on June 28, 1911, in the village of Denshal, actually near Nakhla in the region of Behera, the farmer Mohammed Ali Effendi Hakim heard a terrible noise and saw a white column of smoke streaking across the sky. Fearful, Hakim tried to call his dog in from where it was standing. Before the dog could move, however, a meteorite of several kilograms weight and moving at several thousand kilometers per hour turned the dog into a pile of ashes. "In my dream, I was that dog," Coxie said, "but still also me. The worst thing was, I knew what was coming, but I had no power to change a thing, not even to move so much as an inch out of harm's way." I thought about the odds. For that meteorite to kill that dog, another far more massive meteorite would first have had to slam into the surface of Mars sometime between 11 million and 1.3 billion years back, with enough force to blast into space several tons of Martian surface, which then would have to go into orbit around the sun, bump into still other space rocks over millions or billions of years, until at last one particular shard of all that chance to come in at exactly the wrong time and place to blast that dog to dust. I had been cursed to 9 lives worth of bad luck by a black cat avatar of the ancient Egyptian cat goddess Bastet, according to my dream, anyway. I don't think that's how her name is pronounced, Cogs. I know, but that's the way I think of it. What a nightmare. You'd have to be one cosmically unlucky dog to have been killed by that Martian meteorite in Egypt. Yes, the only recorded fatality of a meteorite strike. I opened the airlock into the core habitat. As I climbed inside with Cogsy, I was still absently pondering the wheels on our home. Although they no longer moved, one could still spin them several ways. Either the habitat was the final stage in an evolutionary arc from orbiter to lander to rover to permanent address, or I lived in a mobile home in the most exotic trailer park in the solar system. The probabilities against all that are astronomical, I said, knowing how much human wordplay made Cogsy, himself the inveterate punster, groan. That day, however, he didn't rise to the bait. I shrugged and continued. I don't give much credit to curses, but I suppose you could argue that any sufficiently improbable natural event is indistinguishable from a supernatural event. But the dream was so vivid, Cogsy said. It all seemed so real, that damned cat and its curse, not least of all. You, the superstitious type, Cogs, I wouldn't have believed it. And now that I think of it, isn't that dog killed by meteorite story apocryphal? No one knows for sure. The story that it's apocryphal may itself be apocryphal. I manually undid the fasteners on our environment suits, which were more like pilots' lightweight, pressurized flight suits than spacesuits for hard vacuum. Undoing Cogsy's suit and helping him out of it, I smiled. He was a crazy smart dog, even on 4 feet and without opposable thumbs. But that was what I had wanted. The quad cycle we rode made its way among the advanced robots I had reactivated and redirected to the next Aerogerant habitation site, not very originally designated, Xanadu 2. "What do you miss most about Earth, boss?" Cogsy said, "besides everything." "Oh, I don't know. I miss the days being 24 hours, as opposed to these longer Martian souls. Being permanently time-lagged is enough to drive you nuts. Let's see, what else? Cities, people, good times with friends, and weather. I miss the weather of Earth." "What about it in particular?" "The way lightning hotwires a thunderstorm sky to make it start raining. The way pine trees and mountain fog look like a darker shade of mist. Mammatus clouds, big orange sunsets, rosy-fingered dawns, all that. What I don't miss is all the political weather." "Political weather?" "The Sturm und Drang, the mass protests we had to put up with against the whole idea of this one-way program. Not that the protesters could ever decide whether aerogerontological colonization was A, the abandonment of a famine-devastated Earth by the super-rich and superannuated, or B, a callous abandoning in place of the elderly. As if Mars were some bizarre combination of billionaire bolt hole and extraterrestrial-assisted living facility. No matter that all of us senior astronauts had been volunteers, I thought. And not all of us had been rich, either. Yet, in the face of global resistance, the entire Aerogerant project began coming off the tracks. Despite all the money spent and all the effort expended by the program's multinational government / corporate consortium, whose board I chaired. With the program itself in danger of being abandoned in place, I bought everyone out. I got all the movables, all the intellectual and real Martian property, the whole show, for a fire sale price of $70 billion. Enough to get me the first one-way ticket to the Red Planet. The dog came along almost for free." "How about you?" I asked Cogsy. In the days since our previous conversation, he had become quieter, less playful, even pensive, one might say. "What do you miss least about Earth?" "Something I didn't even know about when I was there. Something I only learned about here, via the Mars web while researching my dreams. What's that? The phrase, "Fortunately, the only casualty was a dog." I don't know how many times I've seen that. Not very fortunate, I guess, if you're a dog. And in my dreams, I am that dog, again and again. Really? Cogsey nodded as we watched the builder bots extrude Martian sand glass onto the framework of the X2 dome. I dreamed I was in a town in the American Midwest, Kearney, I think it was called, in what I was able to search out later. At a street celebration, the townspeople started up a merry-go-round with a steam calliope, which exploded. The only casualty was a dog. And there's more than just one of these disaster dogs? Many, like I said. I dreamed of a hot, late summer afternoon when I lived in a cottage with a miner, his wife, and 9 kids. The cottage exploded. That happened in August 1915, when a U-boat shelled a coke works near Workington in England, as nearly as I can determine. Fortunately, the only casualty was a dog. "Now, Cogsey, don't be morbid," I said. Phrases from the dream experiment research bubbled up in my head, particularly the idea that dreaming had developed from a simpler threat rehearsal mechanism in animals to a more general virtual rehearsal mechanism in modern humans. According to the research, an important aspect of the initial natural selection of the dream mechanism was that threats encountered in a dream had to be perceived as real by the dreamer. In order for those dream threats to be convincing, however, disbelief had to be suspended. Higher order mental processes had to be deactivated. If waking consciousness in the early hominid brain was very similar to dream consciousness in modern humans, as some researchers contended, where might Cogsey now be along that spectrum? What boundaries might be blurring in Cogsey's mind? "I dreamed of another hot summer day," Cogsey said, mistaking my thoughtful pause for permission to continue. "June, I think. A little boy playing with matches. A fire starts, eventually engulfing 18 houses and a hospital. I run into a blazing building looking for my master, but I'm killed when the door blows shut. I think that episode happened in a town called Sandon in Canada. Fortunately, the only casualty was a dog. Then came another dream of another August day in 1940, as I later learned. A wounded British pilot bails out of his damaged plane over England. His aircraft crashes into a house, but the only casualty was a dog. See the pattern?" "Yes, yes. Stop already with that, Cogsey. I get it. None of that is very nice of us humans, granted. Not at all nice. But it's not worth dwelling on. And do you think you might have your causes and effects reversed?" "What do you mean?" "You mentioned researching the events, and as you later learned, or as near as you can determine, from material found on the Mars web, right?"
"Yes."
"Isn't it possible you found a lot of this on screen first and only dreamed about it, or thought you dreamed about it, later?" Cogsey paused for a moment, then shook himself from head to tail, as if he'd just emerged from a swim or awakened from a long nap. "No, that can't be it. The dreams are too real. Straight through the gate of horn. Maybe my previous avatars had these dreams of their previous avatars too. Maybe in dreams they saw their fetches, their ghostly doubles. And after so many reruns, we figured out that we were all somehow the same unlucky dog." "But they weren't like you, Cogs. Your previous avatars or fetches or whatever you call them. They didn't have your intellectual capabilities." "No, but they might still have had these dreams and instincts." "Cogsey, leave it. My fellow humans' undervaluing of canine lives and deaths may well be a real pattern, but this stuff of cat goddess curses and doomed reruns is all in your head. Obsessing on it only makes it worse. Leave it. I don't want to hear you talking about it again. Is that clear?" Cogsey nodded but said nothing. Only gradually did I realize he was giving me the silent treatment. In silence, we watched the builder bots finish sand-glazing the X2 dome. In silence, we made our way home aboard the Sun Quad. Stubborn, I continued to put the enhancers in his food. Stubborn, he continued to eat. I had forbidden him from talking to me about such matters, but I hadn't forbidden his communicating his dream journals to me via other channels. The networked computing devices of our little Mars web had voice and word recognition capabilities. Not one to let the lack of thumbs and fingers stop him, Cogsey began dictating his thoughts into the system, and soon I was receiving electronically dispatched texts of his recollected dreams. Not a single trace of his old humor could I detect in any of them. 1940 was a busy year. I dreamed of another incident, one that happened in November. My name was Tubby, and I was trapped in an automobile on a suspension bridge in a windstorm. I would not get out of the car and snapped at the man, a kind stranger, who tried to coax me out to safety. It was the original Tacoma Narrows Bridge, also known as Galloping Gertie. The stronger the wind blew, the more the bridge turned sail, twisting and rolling in the wind. I learned that, in the end, what the engineers call aeroelastic flutter caused the bridge to tear itself apart and take roadbed and car and me, the only casualty, into the Narrows. I don't know why I didn't get out of that car. Maybe I figured that if I got out and started walking across that bridge, that kind stranger would die with me. Cogsey, I shot back in reply, the note having irked me greatly. You are obviously confusing what you read from screens with what you see in dreams. Thinking oneself the persecuted focus of a history-transcending curse or conspiracy would, among humans, be considered a sign of paranoid schizophrenia. My scolding didn't stop him from sending another electronic missive later the same week. I was on the St. John's River, speeding along in a ski boat with my human family. We came around a corner and hit another ski boat head-on. Everyone was ejected by the collision. I swam for shore as best I could. Watching the boat sink, I realized how badly hurt I was. While the humans took care of each other and ambulances arrived by land to take all the injured people to the hospital, I faded away. The last words I heard were, "Thank God the only casualty was that dog there. It was in one of the boats." I sent Cogs yet another message, this one reminding him that his continuing 9 deaths for 9 lives obsession was unhealthy, and that mistaking patterns that exist only in one's head for those that actually exist in the world would be yet another indicator of schizophrenic tendencies. Soon we stopped leaving the habitat together for work on the surface. One morning, his only greeting to me was a long, low growl under his breath and muttered curses under that growl. After that, we began avoiding each other. I stopped putting the enhancers in his food, but it must have already been too late. As the situation between us worsened, I felt less and less inclined to keep up any elaborate communication with Earth. I don't know why. I spent more time out on the Martian surface, radiation be damned. Maybe Cogsey did too. I can't say. Another dream journal arrived a few days later. It would be the last. I watched the soldiers coming into our desert city. The night was dark, no moon, clouds obscuring the sky, most of the electric lights out. The soldiers all had night vision gear. No one met them on the streets, but I followed them as they raided one house and another throughout the night. At one point, they saw 2 townsmen whose scent I knew. The soldiers would have shot them, but I caught the townsmen's attention and they ran off. I continued following the soldiers. When I got too close, one of them shot me with what was supposed to be a non-lethal round. I became the only casualty of their securing of the city. For some weeks thereafter, I received nothing more from Cogsey. Continuing to put out food for him, I noticed that he was eating only sporadically. We had become uncertain shadows, glimpsed only fleetingly as we hid from each other. Our mutual affection passed first into indifference, then into loathing. It was only when I received the following message, however, that my feelings turned toward fear. "I know what your dream experiment was really about. I figured it out. I don't want to hurt anybody. No, I don't. But you did this to me. Why? I'm not responsible for Karen's and Susie's deaths. I'm not the one who made his only son feel forsaken. I don't drive to destruction everything I love that loves me back. You made me this way because you're made that way. You're making me do what I have to do to you." After reading the note, I looked around for a weapon.
The only thing that might pass for such in the whole of Xanadu base was the knife I had the bot make from three shards of the Earthborn meteorite we had discovered. I snatched the knife up and tucked it in my belt, feeling foolish the whole time. Yet I soon fashioned a makeshift sheath for it, so I could wear it while out on the surface, too. Not that Cogsy could do much harm there, having no opposable thumbs or weapons, and with his teeth caged by the helmet of his environment suit. But I thought it better to err on the side of caution, just in case. Riding down a branch canyon just before sunset, I was hit by a blur moving with such force that it knocked me clean off my sun quad. The solar quad cycle ran along on two wheels for a moment more before skidding onto its side. Over the suit comm, I heard wild baying and howling, punctuated by the sing-song of, Red Rover, let Cogsy come over. I struggled to get my feet under me, and the blur hit me again from behind. I hit the ground and rolled over onto my back. Above me stood Cogsy, a snarl twisting his muzzle and baring his teeth. He charged at my head, the visor of his environment suit smashing into my helmet visor. Every time I tried to rise to my feet, he knocked me down, refusing to let me get up on 2 feet. His crazy growl and howl and Red Rover sing-song never stopped or let up either, growing only more frenzied, if anything. Again and again and again, he flung himself at my face until I wondered how much punishment our helmets could take. As Cogsy bashed his helmet against mine with insane abandon, I dearly wished I were wearing a full vacuum spacesuit instead of this enviro unit. It felt more flimsy with each blow. A thin crack appeared in the outer pane of my visor. I saw that several such cracks already spidered over Cogsy's. You damn dog, you'll kill us both! He howled and yipped and headbutted his helmet into mine yet again. The crack in my visor became two. If he broke that visor, only the inner pane would stand between my face and the wraith-like thinness of the Martian atmosphere. His howling sing-song rose in pitch as he lunged again. The external visor pane in my helmet shattered. Cogsy left me no choice. I fumbled my meteorite blade from its makeshift sheath. As he lunged, I slashed down. Again and again, the blade flashed and plunged, a swarm of Earthborn meteors in Martian sunset light. My dagger's wild stabbing must have struck something vital in Cogsy, his suit, or both. Cogsy's attacks weakened. His breathing became labored. A series of whimpering cries, so like the dream noises he sometimes made in sleep, sounded over the suit comm. When at last the cries faded away, Cogsy fell on top of me. As I lifted him off of me, I tried not to notice the patches of pinkish red spreading around two holes in his suit just behind the left shoulder. I lay him on the ground beside me as gently as my fatigue-shaken limbs would allow. I grabbed a shovel from its mount on the back of the sun quad. The water didn't well up in my eyes until I was almost finished digging. By the time I dragged Cogsy's corpse to the grave, I was sobbing like a child and could barely see for my tears. I buried him in unearthly earth. I stabbed my meteorite knife into the sand time after time in an attempt to clean the blood off, but it would not come clean. I placed the dagger in Cogsy's grave with him. At the graveside, I could speak no prayers. I thought about how long the odds were against an Earthborn dog being killed on Mars by a knife fashioned from an Earthborn meteorite discovered by that dog on Mars. The only thing more improbable would be the idea that that same hound was also the ninth incarnation of a cat-cursed Egyptian dog first killed on Earth by a meteorite from Mars. Any sufficiently improbable natural event is indistinguishable from a supernatural event, I reminded myself. I have come to think of those words as Cogsy's law and to wonder at the perversity of the cosmos. Yesterday I sent a flurry of messages to Earth, endowing with a full 15% of my remaining wealth
a foundation whose research will focus on the genetic engineering of bipedalism, opposable digits, greater fetalization, brain growth, longevity, and other trans-specific characteristics into subaltern species, especially canine stock. I only wish I could call such work dogmentation in Cogsey's presence to see how he'd react. After sending those instructions and overriding all my son Paul's objections, I took my first dose of the dream enhancers I had been feeding Cogsey. Last night I dreamed that, reflected in Cogsey's helmet visor, I saw myself take off my suit helmet. In that reflection, I watch his soft brown eyes watch me next remove from my head the visor-shaped faceplate in which my eyes, nose, and lips are mounted. Behind that detached face, I see nothing. No shooting stars or flashing neurons or machine readouts, just a reflection of dark emptiness, echoing with detached words from detached lips. Red Rover, Red Rover, let this old man come over. In Cogsey's eyes, I see no final judgment, and I hope for forgiveness. I look down at the moons in the quick of my fingernails. I look up through the dome at the fingernail moons in the dead of the Martian night. I remember Cogsey's nails on my arms when he jumped up to greet me. I think about the quick and the dead and the universe and me, holding on by our fingernails against the big nothing behind the night sky, behind my eyes.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was Howard Hendricks reading Red Rover, Red Rover, a challenging yet rewarding science fiction drama by an author we've had on many times. Here's this billionaire who's given up his fortune so that he can move to Mars because somehow, for him, life was no longer livable on Earth since his wife and daughter had passed away. He took Cogsey, his dog, with him, but because of an insatiable appetite to do scientific experimentation, and because he evidently was a type that can't leave well enough alone, he gives the dog some specialized medicated food that makes him dream. And when he analyzes those dreams, it seems the only thing the dog can focus on is how, throughout history, mankind has always saved himself at the expense of dogs. In each of the dog's reminiscences, the conclusion always seems to be the only casualty was the canine. As a result, the two of them, who were once such good friends, become mortal enemies, and finally, Cogsey attacks his owner, who uses a knife to defend himself, and kills the dog, an act he soon very much regrets. Makes us wonder how we've treated our pets all these years. And at the very end of the story, he starts to take some of that dream medicine himself. How do you suppose all that is going to work out? Friends, our author tonight, Howard Hendricks, has probably more publishing credits to his name than any other writer we've ever had on our show. His publications include 6 major novels published by nationally recognized publishing houses. A year ago alone, Howard published a collection of stories entitled Human in the Circuit. He also served as the lead editor for a scholarly nonfiction book entitled Visions of Mars, Essays in the Fiction and Science of the Red Planet. As we told you earlier, Howard is a professor of English at Fresno State University and makes his home up at Shaver Lake. We very much thank him for his story tonight, as well as many other contributions to our program over the years. And of course, we look forward to more of those wonderful science fiction stories for future programs. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, I'll be reading a story of mine. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.